Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Sickle cell disease is the most common inherited blood disorder in the United States. While patients have experienced improved survival rates thanks to mandatory newborn screening, the disease is still associated with notable acute and chronic complications. Hydroxyurea is the mainstay medication for sickle cell maintenance therapy, but given its tendency to induce bone marrow suppression, it's not an ideal agent. Fortunately for sickle cell patients, the past few years have welcomed three new medications, including L-glutamine, crizanlizumab, and voxelotor, all of which may have a better safety profile and efficacy when compared to hydroxyurea. During today's podcast, my pharmacist colleague, Dr. Deanne Timms, will discuss the evidence behind these three new medications.
Thank you, Garrett, for that introduction. Sickle cell disease was first reported in the literature in 1910 by Dr. James Herrick. He described it as a peculiar, elongated, and sickle-shaped red blood corpuscles in a case of severe anemia. There's been some recent interest in sickle cell disease management in recent years, trying to come up with different agents that tackle a variety of both the acute and chronic complications that are associated with sickle cell disease. Throughout this presentation, I'd like to describe the pathophysiology and complications associated with sickle cell disease, review our current treatment modalities of sickle cell disease from the guidelines, and discuss recent literature regarding advancements in sickle cell disease therapy. As an overview, sickle cell disease is an autosomal recessive genetic condition. It's the most commonly inherited blood disorder in the United States, and roughly 100,000 Americans do have sickle cell disease. Long-term survival rates have improved since mandated newborn screenings have been implemented in all 50 states. The symptoms of sickle cell disease appear around ages 5 to 6 months, and they present with acute pain, fatigue, and jaundice. Sickle cell disease affects millions of people throughout the world, primarily of African descent, where it's estimated that 1 in 13 African-American newborn children will have sickle cell trait. It's also prevalent among other populations, such as Hispanic, European, Mediterranean, Native American, Middle Eastern, and Asian Indian background. It's estimated that each year, 1,000 babies in the United States and 500,000 worldwide will be born with sickle cell disease. So now to talk a little bit about the nomenclature that's associated with sickle cell disease, because a lot of the definitions are used quite interchangeably. So we have hemoglobin with our alpha and beta subunits, where sickle cell disease is primarily affecting the beta globin genes. First up, we have sickle cell disorder, which is defined as having a sickled hemoglobin S gene mutation on at least one of these beta globin genes. Next is sickle cell trait, where you have one normal hemoglobin A gene and one hemoglobin S gene mutation. Sickle cell trait is also known as being a benign carrier status, so you don't have the disease, but you have the trait and can pass it on to your kids. Sickle cell disease is more formally defined as having that hemoglobin S mutation plus a second beta globin gene mutation. And it can be in a more mild form where that gene mutation is a C hemoglobin gene or more rare forms of D, E, and O hemoglobin. Sickle cell anemia is a type of sickle cell disease where you have the presence of two of these sickled cell genes, so it's hemoglobin SS nomenclature. And finally, sickle beta thalassemia is another commonly associated blood disorder with sickle cell that affects our hemoglobin on the beta gene. And so with beta thalassemia, beta zero is more of a severe disease, and this is where patients would present more like those with hemoglobin SS sickle cell, whereas beta plus, they would have more of a mild disease presentation. When we think about the pathophysiology of sickle cell disease, we have a blood vessel filled with red blood cells that are able to travel throughout. In sickle cell disease, what happens is that these red blood cells become deoxygenated, and processes that can affect this include hypoxia, acidosis, and dehydration. And what happens to our red blood cells is that they become sickle-shaped, so this crescent moon shape. And what happens when they become misshapen like this is they kind of clog things up and get stuck. So there's two different processes that are going on in this pathophysiology that we'll explore in some other slides when we're talking about some of the medication agents. But what's happening is there's polymerization of the red blood cell. So it has this crescent moon shape and its rigidity, and it breaks down and it causes hemolysis of the red blood cells. And then there's adhesion that's going on the endothelial cell surface, where that's what makes these cells sticky and clogs up the vasculature. Disease complications for sickle cell disease can be broken down into both acute and chronic disease complications. For acute, we think of things such as fever and infection, vaso-occlusion, also known as acute pain crisis, dactylitis, acute chest syndrome, stroke, priapism, splenic sequestration, and aplastic crisis. For more of our chronic disease manifestations in sickle cell, we expect anemia that can be associated with iron overload with red blood cell transfusions, dysfunctional spleen and being more prone to risk of infection, and then multi-system organ damage, primarily renal disease, but you can also see heart failure, pulmonary hypertension, retinopathy, skin ulcers, and avascular necrosis. So basically, sickle cell creates a whole path of disease complications for patients later in life and can lead to early death. So when we think about agents that are being used for sickle cell disease management, they're primarily trying to target the acute complications of vaso-occlusive crisis. And this acute pain crisis is described as a deep throbbing pain that can be widespread throughout the body. It's the most common reason that sickle cell patients are presenting to the ED or are hospitalized. Sometimes there's kind of this assumption that goes with sickle cell disease patients where they're thought to have drug-seeking behavior due to the need for oftentimes IV or PCA opioid medications to be able to alleviate this pain crisis, and can just lead to other chronic pain management issues. When we think about when patients present here to Mayo, I've only seen a handful of sickle cell patients, but oftentimes for the peds patients, our COMPASS team will be involved and they are managing the pain on the outpatient basis. So when a patient comes in through the ED, we can go into their chart and see what the pain management line is when they come to the ED. Other management considerations in pain crisis include treating underlying precipitating factors. Was there some kind of stress or trauma or temperature kind of induced pain that happened? Are they maintaining adequate hydration? And we should avoid any delays in analgesia. And the choice of which agent we use really depends on the history of their response, patterns of use, how often they're using pain medications outside of being inpatient, their current status using pain scales to assess where their pain level is at, and thinking about their other medical conditions that could be contributing to pain. Pain management can range from a variety of our non-opioid to opioid and adjuvant options. When patients are coming to the ED or needing hospitalization, like I mentioned before, they often require IV or PCA administration of opioid medications. So this brings us to our first question. You can respond at pollev.com/MayoRx or by texting MayoRx to 22333, picking A, B, or C, A, B, C, or D. So which of the following would be classified as the most severe form of sickle cell? Hemoglobin AS, hemoglobin S beta 0, hemoglobin S beta plus, or hemoglobin SC? All right, it looks like we have a good majority of the responses in, and so I would agree with the majority here that the hemoglobin S beta 0 is our most severe form of sickle cell disease. If you recall, hemoglobin AS, we have one normal hemoglobin, which is the A gene, and then one sickle cell S gene, and so this means that you have carrier status, but you don't have the disease. Hemoglobin S beta 0 is where you have two sickle genes, and of the beta thalassemias, beta 0 is the most severe form. Hemoglobin S beta plus is where you again have the two sickle beta genes, but the beta plus is the more mild form of this thalassemia. And then the hemoglobin SC, you have one sickle mutation and one abnormal hemoglobin C. There's just less severe symptoms associated with this type of sickle cell. Moving on a little bit to talk about more of the chronic health maintenance recommendations from the NHLBI guidelines are kind of focused on four pillars here of hydroxyurea, allogeneic stem cell transplant, red blood cell transfusions, and infection prevention. So hydroxyurea was first approved by the FDA in 1998, and in various studies it's been proven to reduce and prevent many sickle cell disease complications through a variety of mechanisms, including increasing fetal hemoglobin F, so hemoglobin F, and so this causes less sickling and decreased hemolysis. And so hemoglobin F is an interesting variation of hemoglobin because it just binds better to oxygen, and so we're able to get rid of that hemoglobin S mutation that's happening and have better oxygenation of our red blood cells within the vasculature. And so thinking about hemoglobin F, the nadir of hemoglobin, of this type of hemoglobin is around 6 to 9 months of age, which makes sense when we start to think about where the disease presentation is most noticeable in kids. It's around 5 to 6 months, so it's kind of when this fetal hemoglobin is wearing off, and then we start to see the disease manifestations taking place. Other mechanisms that hydroxyurea is thought to act by include increasing nitric oxide levels, which helps with vasodilation and vascular response, reducing neutrophil and monocytes, which helps with decreasing inflammation, and lessening the adhesion of cells to the vascular wall, which improves our tissue oxygenation. Hydroxyurea, there are limited safety and efficacy data in pediatrics, but we typically start using it in ages 9 months of age and older, which again aligns with that nadir that we see in hemoglobin F production in the body. Initially, we'll start dosing at 20 milligrams per kilo per day, with dose increases by 5 milligrams per kilo per day every 8 weeks to a maximum dose of 2,500 milligrams daily, or 35 milligrams per kilo per day. Thinking about toxicity and when we might stop or hold therapy are when the ANC is between 1,500 and 3,000, or when our platelets drop below 80. It's okay to reinitiate hydroxyurea at 5 milligrams per kilo per day lower than the dose that patient was using prior to seeing some of these myelosuppressive effects. The pros and cons of hydroxyurea are shown here. Pros are that it decreases complications associated with sickle cell disease, reduces ED visits and hospitalizations and thereby costs that are associated with these, and it improves the overall quality of life and overall survival of patients with sickle cell disease, which makes sense. This has been kind of our mainstay of drug therapy for many years in sickle cell disease. The cons are that patients have kind of spotty compliance with hydroxyurea, so that can influence how well it works. Some patients just don't respond to hydroxyurea treatment in general. It doesn't have any secondary stroke prevention. It's a hazardous medication, and a lot of times why people stop taking this medication is because of the side effects associated with the bone marrow suppression. Next, I want to talk a little bit about stem cell transplant. So this is the only curative option for sickle cell disease at this time. There have been some preliminary studies looking at gene therapy, but I just don't think that we're quite seeing that implemented enough to be able to recommend that as a guideline recommendation at this time. With stem cell transplant, the overall survival rate with sibling matched donors is about 95%, and there's an increased risk of mortality without having that HLA match. So our optimal candidates for stem cell transplant would be patients who are younger than 16 years of age, have severe sickle cell disease with disease complications, and have that HLA compatible full sibling. Risks associated with stem cell transplant include graft versus host disease, having that mismatched donor, and any other secondary malignancies that the patient may have. Chronic red blood cell transfusions are used in sickle cell disease management to dilute the amount of sickled red blood cells with healthy red blood cells, so this lessens the degree of hemolysis and helps correct anemia. Red blood cell transfusions are typically done every 3 to 4 weeks and are adjusted to help maintain a hemoglobin S concentration that is less than 30% of a patient's total hemoglobin. Risks associated with transfusions include blood hyperviscosity, having volume overload, and iron depositions, which leads us to having to use iron chelation therapy with the agents listed here. Finally, thinking about sickle cell disease management is infections, where there's a dysfunctional spleen present in sickle cell disease. So the spleen's important for clearing out a lot of these encapsulated bacteria that are responsible for various bacteremias, meningitis, and pneumonias. And so in sickle cell disease, they have this dysfunctional spleen. And so it's a major cause of morbidity and mortality, specifically thinking about sepsis and meningitis with the bugs like strep pneumo, H flu, and meningitis. And then there's more presence of infections caused by some of our atypical bugs, such as Mycoplasma pneumoniae. Other infectious concerns would be viral pneumonias and then osteomyelitis caused by Salmonella species. And so addressing this dysfunctional spleen, we focus on infection prophylaxis primarily through immunizations, the pneumococcal and meningococcal vaccines, and then penicillin prophylaxis. So with penicillin prophylaxis, who should be getting it? All infants who have hemoglobin SS or any variation of the hemoglobin S beta thalassemias. What should they get? If they are less than 3 years of age, they should get penicillin 125 PO BID. And if they're 3 years of age and up, they can get 250 milligrams PO BID. When do they get it? We start at age 2 months of age and continue until they're 5 years old. And this is more or less just a bridge to get us to when they're old enough to get some of the immunizations of pneumococcal and meningococcal. And so there have been studies that show that why we do this is that it has decreased infections and risk of death versus no prophylaxis whatsoever until those immunizations can occur. So that brings us to our next question. Again, you can respond at polyv.com. or texting Mayo Rx. So a 4-year-old female has been diagnosed with hemoglobin SS, sickle cell disease. What is an appropriate initial therapy regimen? Hydroxyurea 20 milligrams per kilo per day, hydroxyurea 20 milligrams per kilo per day, plus penicillin 125 BID, hydroxyurea 35 milligrams per kilo per day, plus penicillin 125 BID, or hydroxyurea 20 milligrams per kilo per day with penicillin 250 BID. All right, so it looks like we have the majority of answers in now, and I would agree with the 100% of you who have responded in that D is the correct answer. So A is incorrect because this patient would need penicillin prophylaxis because they're under age 5. B is incorrect because this dosing of the penicillin would be recommended if they were younger than 3 years of age. C is incorrect because that hydroxyurea would be the maximum dose that we would use in a patient, not our starting therapy. And D is correct because we would start at 20 milligrams per kilo per day of hydroxyurea, and because this patient is 4, we would use penicillin 250 BID. So transitioning a little bit and thinking about some of our newer therapy options, there have been about 4 agents that have been studied extensively in literature and made it all the way to phase 3 trials. There have been other agents that affect different components of the vasculature that are starting to be explored, but they haven't had a lot of randomized clinical controlled trials yet. Looking at a little bit of a timeline here, in 2017 is when L-glutamine, or the branded Endari, came into play. Rivipansel in August 2019. This one is an interesting agent because it made it to phase 3 trials that started back in 2015. They wrapped up last June, but then in August of 2019, they came out with a statement saying that these phase 3 trials failed to meet safety and efficacy standards in terms of being able to decrease vaso-occlusive disease and opioid pain medications. And so although this medication had been on the fast track through the FDA and being approval and having orphan drug status, they pulled this agent in terms of being able to move forward with it as a potential treatment option. But it had been one of our major newer therapy options since this Endari came to market. Following the rivipansel is this crizanlizumab, which was approved in November of 2019, and also voxalotor, which was also approved by the FDA in 2019. So very recent medications. And like I said, rivipansel, I'm not going to be talking about this medication today, but I am going to dive into the phase 2 and 3 trials of these other 3 medications. So looking at L-glutamine, this is proposed to be an anti-inflammatory amino acid that can help regulate and prevent oxidative damage to red blood cells in sickle cell disease management. The dosing, it comes as a packet and it's weight-based, so less than 30 kilos, you'd use 1 packet twice a day, 30 to 65 kilos, 2 packets twice a day, and greater than 65 kilos is 3 packets twice a day. Common adverse effects associated with L-glutamine include nausea, constipation, headache, and arthralgias. And in terms of monitoring, the package insert recommends looking at renal and hepatic function, but they don't suggest any sort of dose adjustment based on impairment of the kidneys or the liver. So the study that was done by Nahara et al. In 2018 for L-glutamine was a phase 3 randomized controlled trial that was looking at L-glutamine versus placebo, where they were dosing the L-glutamine at 0.3 grams per kilo by mouth twice daily. Their primary outcome of interest was looking at pain crisis incidents, and their inclusion criteria was that they randomly assigned patients in a 2-to-1 fashion for L-glutamine versus placebo, where patients had to be at least 5 years of age, be diagnosed with hemoglobin SS or hemoglobin S-beta 0, have at least 2 pain crisis events in the past year, and if they were taking hydroxyurea prior to the study, they had to be on a stable dose for the last 3 months and they couldn't be started on hydroxyurea while enrolled in the study. You can see here that the baseline characteristics between our treatment and placebo group were pretty similar throughout, where about 2/3 of the patients were taking hydroxyurea. Many of them had between 2 and 5 pain crisis events in the past year. In their primary outcome endpoint, they were looking at the median number of pain crisis events, and you can see that with placebos, about 4 events versus L-glutamine was a little over 3, so this was a statistically significant result. Looking more specifically at their secondary outcomes, they found that hospitalizations, ED visits related to pain crisis, cumulative days in the hospital, median times to both first and second pain crisis events, and then having at least 1 episode of acute chest were all statistically significant in favor of L-glutamine, having less hospital days, less days to pain crisis, and acute chest syndrome. looking at their safety analysis, they didn't report any p-values with these events, but some of our most common ones are the ones that we'll see in the package insert too, where L-glutamine causes more constipation, nausea, a lot of these GI symptoms, which makes sense with the PO formulation that it's available in. It also caused some kind of nonspecific chest pain, so that's something to think about as well, but no statistical significance among the treatment versus placebo group when we think about safety. Transitioning a little bit to talk about crizanlizumab, this is classified as an anti-adhesion monoclonal antibody, and it's proposed to help maintain the normal blood flow of white blood cells by binding to P-selectin to stop vaso-occlusion, and I'll show you what that mechanism looks like in the next slide. The dosing that we use for crizanlizumab is it's approved for use in patients who are 16 years of age and up, and at weeks 0 and 2, they'll receive 5 milligrams per kilo IV administered over 30 minutes, and then subsequent doses are 5 milligrams per kilo every 4 weeks. Adverse effects associated with crizanlizumab include nausea, arthralgia, and back pain. And in terms of monitoring parameters, infusion-related reactions were the most commonly reported. So looking again at this mechanism of action, we have our endothelial cell that has expression of P-selectin. P-selectin is a protein that's important for adhesion within the endothelium. You have our white blood cell that's able to come in and bind to P-selectin. And so if we think about sickle cell disease on how it affects the red blood cells, it causes that misshapen crescent moon shape. It has that sticky adhesions that allows it to get clogged up in the vasculature. So a similar type of adhesion is happening with the white blood cells to the endothelium, where they're able to bind to this P-selectin. And so then when you have your white blood cells that are kind of sticky and the red blood cells that are sticky, it causes a lot of vaso-occlusion within the vasculature. And that's what leads to these vaso-occlusive crises. And so then with crizanlizumab, you have your endothelial cell with P-selectin, but before the white blood cell is able to come in and bind to P-selectin, crizanlizumab comes in and stops that, so we don't get adhesion of the white blood cells within the endothelium. So in 2017, the SUSTAIN trial was conducted. This was a phase 2 randomized controlled trial where they were looking at crizanlizumab versus placebo. They broke things down into a high dose versus a low dose, high dose versus low dose versus placebo. And they, again, were looking at the annual pain crisis rate in these patients. For inclusion criteria, patients had to be at least 16 years of age. They could have pretty much any of the sickle cell disease genotypes, had to have at least 2 pain crisis events in the past year, and again, had to be on a stable hydroxyurea dose for at least 3 months prior to the study. Baseline characteristics, are very similar, where we have about 62% of patients who were concomitantly on hydroxyurea. Majority of patients had between 2 and 4 pain crisis events, and then about 38% of patients had 5 to 10. So again, this is all really similar to the L-glutamine study that we saw previously in terms of just being able to compare kind of apples to oranges, so to speak. The primary outcome in the crizanlizumab study was looking at median crisis rate per year. And so you can see both in the intention to treat and per protocol analyses that the high dose crizanlizumab was statistically significant for having less pain crisis events versus placebo. And what I thought was interesting about this study is that they reported the number of patients who had a crisis rate of 0 by the end of the study. And so you can see 24 of the 67 patients who received the high dose crizanlizumab had no pain crisis events, which I thought was really cool. And similar with the per protocol analysis, they saw about 1/3 of those patients had no pain crisis events. Looking at some of their secondary outcomes, again, we were looking at the median rate of hospitalized days, which didn't show any statistical significance among the groups. However, the median time to first and second pain crises were statistically significant in favor of the high-dose crizanlizumab group. And if you notice on some of these interquartile ranges, they report that some of these higher ends are not reportable, and so that means that patients just weren't hospitalized. And so that's why those values aren't there. Looking at safety analysis, they broke it down into adverse events versus serious adverse events. So what does that mean? Adverse events were classified as things like headache, back pain, nausea, arthralgia, and UTI, whereas more serious adverse events would be fever, infection, influenza, pneumonia. And they saw that people who had a serious adverse event in any of these groups was around 30%, not statistically significant, and anyone who had at least one adverse event, one of these nonspecific ones like headache or back pain, happened in about 90% of patients. Finally, talking a little bit about voxelotor, this is classified as an anti-sickling agent, and so it's proposed to regulate hemoglobin affinity for oxygen, which is what stops hemoglobin polymerization. And again, I'll show this mechanism on the next slide. But this is thought to decrease the concentration of deoxygenated sickled hemoglobin. For dosing of oxalator, it's approved for use in ages 12 and up at 1500 milligrams by mouth daily. There are specific dose adjustments that are recommended for hepatic impairment, as well as if patients are also concomitantly taking CYP3A4 inducers or inhibitors. Adverse effects associated with voxalator include headache, diarrhea, abdominal pain, nausea, and rash. And monitoring with this agent would include looking at hemoglobin levels, hepatic function, and any hypersensitivity reactions. So the mechanism of action of voxalator, if you remember back to one of my first pathophysiology slides, we have our red blood cell, and what happens in sickle cell is that we lose oxygen, and it becomes this deoxygenated sickled shape. So thinking more on a molecular level, what does that look like? We have an oxygenated monomer that becomes deoxygenated and forms this deoxygenated polymer. So this is what's causing it to have that rigid crescent shape and holding that. So this is the polymerization that's what's contributing to it. So voxalator comes in, stops this deoxygenation process from happening, and so we have our red blood cells are able to maintain that round shape with oxygen to decrease the amount of hemoglobin S deoxygenated cells that are present. The HOPE trial was conducted in 2019, where this was a phase 3 randomized controlled trial comparing voxalator versus placebo. Again, we broke it down into a high versus low dose to see what effects those would have. And conversely, with the other two medications, the HOPE trial, they were looking primarily at hemoglobin response, where they defined that as an increase of greater than 1 gram per deciliter from baseline. So they weren't necessarily looking at the number of pain crisis events that the other studies were looking at. Inclusion criteria included patients had to be at least 12 years of age, could have any of the sickle cell disease genotypes. They had to have a baseline hemoglobin level of 5.5 to 10.5. They had to have at least one vaso-occlusive crisis in the past year. And this is another important detail to point out as well. If we think about the other two agents that I mentioned, with those studies, they had to have at least 2 crisis events. And so just keeping this in the back of your mind, where just a patient, if they had at least 1 pain crisis event in the last year, they could be in this study. And again, being on a stable hydroxyurea dose for the previous 3 months. Baseline characteristics of the patients, we can see that the median range of baseline hemoglobin was about 8.5 for the patients in the 3 groups. About 40% had at least 1 pain crisis in the past year. 60% had 2 to 10 pain crises in the past year. And about 2/3 of patients were concomitantly on hydroxyurea while in this study. The primary outcome, again, was looking at hemoglobin response. So again, that was an increase in hemoglobin from baseline by at least 1 gram per deciliter. So we can see that the high-dose voxalator group had a statistically significant hemoglobin response at the end of the week 24 mark. Looking at some of the secondary outcomes, so this is focused more on the laboratory markers. And so kind of in summary, what they found was that the high-dose voxalator versus placebo resulted in a greater change in hemoglobin level, so seeing an increase of greater than 1. So you can see on the table here that that absolute change was 1.1, so it just barely met the criteria of being defined as a response. It was also associated with decreased hemolysis markers. So remember, hemolysis is a big pathophysiology mechanism within sickle cell disease, and so having less of this hemolysis that's happening can potentially impact the disease manifestation of sickle cell. They did report vaso-occlusive crisis in the patients in the 3 groups, where they didn't find any statistical significance for the annual incidence rate, having 1 or more pain crisis events, or just total number of pain crises throughout the study period. For safety analysis, they just reported if patients had any sort of adverse event happen throughout the study period, and it was almost all patients, where they would have adverse events such as headache, diarrhea, nausea, and extremity pain. And so kind of recapping, looking at the 3 different agents that we've talked about, kind of comparing them side by side by side, the age restrictions are quite different between these agents. In the L-glutamine, they were looking at patients as young as 5 years of age, whereas in the crizanlizumab study, they had to be at least 16. Looking at baseline pain crises for these patients, for L-glutamine and crizanlizumab, they had to have at least 2 pain crisis events, versus voxalator, patients only had to have 1 pain crisis event. Looking at the results of these primary outcomes, the annual pain crisis incidence was decreased and statistically significantly decreased in glutamine and crizanlizumab, but there wasn't a significant effect in the voxelotor study. Looking at median time to pain crises, this was reduced in both the glutamine and crizanlizumab group, and it wasn't reported in the voxelotor group. Effect on hemoglobin, voxelotor, that's the HOPE trial was the only one to actually look at the measurement of hemoglobin, whereas the other studies are more focused on disease manifestation and like pain. You can see that from these three medications, the adverse effects are kind of similar between having headache, nausea, any sort of back pain or extremity pain. Something else to consider with these agents too would be cost, what type of formulation they're available in, how often it's getting administered, and where patients can get these medications. So I think if I remember it, the average wholesale price of the L-glutamine, it's like $20 for a packet. So if you're thinking of the patients who weigh 65 kilos, they're doing three packets twice a day. That's a lot of money. A lot of insurances, I don't think, are covering this medication at this time, but there are potentially some copay assistance programs that are available through the manufacturer. Crizanlizumab is a little bit more of a chunk of change because they have to come to the infusion center to get it. I think it's like $250 a vial for this medication. And then voxelotor, I was looking at the pricing, and while it's a tablet, you would think it would be a little bit cheaper, but looking at that price, it's like $120 per tablet, which is crazy too if you're thinking about the patients who are getting 1,500 milligrams per each of their daily doses. So those are just things to consider. Prior authorizations are likely needed on all three of these agents, and whether or not insurances are going to approve them, I think they're still kind of too new to be able to see them readily used. And then the different manufacturers do have varying degrees of copay assistance available to patients. But kind of the caveat is that patients who are Medicare, Medicaid, unless if they have anything besides commercial insurance, they might not be eligible. So this brings us to our last response question. So CP is a 16-year-old female with hemoglobin SS who is compliant with her current hydroxyurea therapy. Her pain has become unmanageable and she has visited the ED 4 times in the past 2 months. What would be a reasonable therapy to trial at this time? Blood transfusions, L-glutamine, crizanlizumab, or voxelotor. All right, I think this is the majority of responders, and I'm glad that there's kind of some mixed feelings on what we would do for this patient. And I don't know that there's necessarily a right or a wrong answer. I think any of these could potentially be options. So let's kind of talk through them one by one. So I think the blood transfusions could be okay. We don't know if this patient struggles with any sort of anemia or anything like that, and we'd want to be cautious with that because it's associated with the iron overload, and so there might just be more steps that are associated with that, but not necessarily a wrong answer. L-glutamine could be a great option for this patient as well. She seems compliant with hydroxyurea, so then maybe she'll have a good track record with taking the packets of glutamine. Something to consider would just be if insurance is going to cover those packets for her. Crizanlizumab, this is the answer that I would pick, primarily because this patient is really struggling with pain crisis management, and of the three clinical trials that were done with the latter three answers, crizanlizumab had the biggest kind of bang for your buck in terms of being able to decrease pain crisis episodes, and then voxelotor didn't have any data associated with being able to reduce pain crisis events, so I would kind of stray away from that option. But yeah, I think L-glutamine or crizanlizumab, depending on kind of where patient preferences, are they okay doing PO therapy versus coming to the ITC? What do these costs look like for the patient? I think either of these could be good answers because she seems to be struggling most just with pain crisis episodes and coming to the ED a lot. And so these would both be potentially cost-saving options for her in terms of not having to come to the hospital. So in summary, sickle cell disease is a genetic disorder that's characterized by the misshaped red blood cells and adhesion of the red blood cells, which leads to a whole myriad of multi-system effects, both acute and chronic sequelae. Our standard treatment modalities include stem cell transplant, red blood cell transfusions, infection prophylaxis, and the use of hydroxyurea as our main pharmacologic option. And then recent medications that have been studied, including L-glutamine, crizanlizumab, and voxelotor, may have an additive role in improving sickle cell disease management. I don't think hydroxyurea is going anywhere, and I don't think that these agents are going to necessarily replace hydroxyurea because we saw that most of the patients were taking hydroxyurea plus this, and so plus one of these agents. And so I think that there's something to be said about additive roles of medications targeting different mechanistic pathways that are associated with sickle cell disease to help improve overall morbidity and mortality of these patients.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.